Welcome to After Hours at the Book Club. It's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. Joining us at the Book Club this month is Gabriel Tallant, his brand new debut novel, My Absolute Darling. You can hear the full interview with Gabriel about the book at the Book Club edition of this podcast. But we're going to get into some more stuff and particularly the place. And we did talk about how beautifully you write about nature and the sense of place. I really got a sense that you have a very personal attachment to this part of Northern California, that I know you grew up there. You also talk about the people who live there, and there's a real contrast between, I suppose, the old hippies who've been living in the woods for forever, the new Silicon Valley millionaires who, you know, get the prime real estate on the cliff, and some of the loners who live up and maybe are grown weed up in the mountains. I mean, was that an accurate description of what it was like when you were growing up?
Yeah, it was. You know, it's tough because Mendocino sort of defies all stereotypes, and it becomes like, it's such a particular place filled with such individual people that it becomes impossible to talk about it in general terms. But
it's very beautiful. You know, I've been there. It's one of the most beautiful spots in the country, I think. You spent part of your youth tramping around, backpacking, right? Is that something you really enjoyed from an early age, just running around that area?
Absolutely. I used to get up before school and run down to the creek to go look for Pacific giant salamanders. And I just remember the feeling of wonder about it. Like every morning you'd get up and you'd be like, what am I going to find, you know? And so I loved this place tremendously, and it was an idyllic childhood, just filled with sort of the wonder of exploring and of the things that you could find. And Mendocino sort of yields infinitely to exploration because it's stair steps away from the coast, mm-hmm. and so it has all of these distinct ecologies. So if you're like willing to kind of hoof it around, you keep finding new places, new ecological niches with their own plants and creatures and vistas. So this is a very meaningful place to me.
Were you as adept in the woods as Turtle, or were you somewhere between your character Turtle and maybe the boys Jacob and Brett, who are very amateurish compared to Turtle, but are still out there backpacking and trying to spend some time out in the woods in a way that not a lot of kids really do these days? So I was wondering, where do you fall in that spectrum of how adept you were out there?
Yeah, sort of, you know, went on a personal odyssey from starting very young, just sort of like running around barefoot, tramping all over, to like in high school getting pretty organized about it and being a serious lightweight backpacker and spending, you know, like weeks at a stretch on long solo backpacking trips. Sort of not like, you know, I sort of not like either. I was a very serious young person and really invested in like being a good backpacker, but Turtle isn't technically interested in gear, or she's just sort of a walker. I had my own particular relationship to those places.
You didn't have canned cheese like the boys do who are hiking through.
I did go out on a trip with a friend and three friends, and we each agreed to bring food for one day because we were out for 3 days. You know, and so for the first day, it was like I brought like sausage and cheese and focaccia, and I mean, you know, we didn't have stoves or water purifiers or anything, so we had to like food that you could just eat without cooking. And you know, I forget what my other buddy brought, but then the last day I was like, is like our friend busted out like 24 hard boiled eggs and a can of easy cheese and like a bunch of saltines, like an entire box of saltines, and we were like, oh god,
you're banned from the next backpacking trip. There's actually a lot of there are quite a few scenes where Turtle and the boys and Turtle and her granddad kind of forage for food, or certainly find food in nature, whether it's mussels or eels. And then there's a scene where the scorpion.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, I didn't think that was possible, but it,
live scorpion.
A live scorpion. Have you seen somebody do that or have you done it yourself?
I've done it and I don't recommend it.
You need a scorpion.
Yeah.
So you hold it by the tail and lower it into your mouth?
Our scorpions on the coast are not real dangerous. We should leave scorpions alone. You know, they're a really important part of the ecosystem and you shouldn't eat them. But did on a dare as a young person.
What was it like? Yeah. I mean, there's a real description of the crunching and she's like, choo, 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 because he got to crunch through us. Ooh.
Yeah. So you find them and they do this threat display where they lift up their tails. And at first it just became a game of trying to handle them with your bare hands, which... again, I don't recommend. Turns out not to be that tough, right? They're actually kind of docile creatures. So you can just lift them up by, because they display that tail, and you just lift it up and you just sort of nestle the barb between your fingers so it doesn't get you, right? And for the most part, they just hang and sort of reach around. Every once in a while, you have one that can curl around and grab you, and then you're in sort of a tight spot as far as putting it back down. And then I regret it, but I did eat a few, yeah.
But we're not advocating the consumption of live scorpions here at all.
Maybe we get them on the food show.
There you go. Radio Nipples, scorpions. But you talk a lot about the people in this particular area as well. And you do say, as I said, it's a mixture of hippies and the Silicon Valley folks. I mean, was that when you were growing up, could you see changes in the demographics of people who'd been there for years and then some of the new money coming into that part of California?
Absolutely. You know, we were very aware of it and we were very aware of issues of tourism and... you know, there's very much a feeling of what Mendocino is and like what it represents and what kind of the spirit of the place, which is very progressive, very radically political. So yes, there's very much a sense of like of the locals versus the influx, which is interesting because. You know, we lived in Albion for a while, and Albion had a magazine called Country Woman Magazine, which attracted radical, back-to-the-land lesbian feminists from sort of all across the nation. So along the Albion Ridge, there was this, and elsewhere, and Comchi too a little bit, there was this streak of political... feminist thought and people who had bought land collectively and built their own houses. And so that hopefulness, that idealism was still very much in the air, even though I was sort of coming after the heyday of that. Like a lot of those communes and joint undertakings were disintegrating.
Was that why your mothers ended up there? I mean, were they kind of at the tail end of that wave?
Yeah, Gloria was there. Gloria worked at a food co-op, an amazing food co-op called Corners of the Mouth, which just had these fantastic, politically motivated, insightful. Employees voluble on political problems and philosophy. It was like, and so I spent a lot of time there as a young person, sort of, you know, wandering through that. And it's in an old church, and it's incredible. It's sort of full of all these political bumper stickers and pins, and it was like a great place to be wandering around as a kid, you know.
You know, so you grew up with two mothers. One of them was Elizabeth Talent. Who is quite an acclaimed writer in her own right. She recently had a book out after not having a book for a long time, and I just wonder what your writing relationship was with her during working on this and if she's influenced you in ways that show in your writing.
Yeah, you know, we used to read Dickens by the fireplace at night. And if that's not an education in literature, I don't know what is. I mean, you read to your daughter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You aware that that is sort of an undertaking and in demonstrating, like, you're, what you're doing is modeling how to view the world. Like, those books that you choose matter.
Mm-hmm.
He's nodding.
Yeah.
Well, he feels it.
Well, we just read Tom Sawyer. We had some interesting conversations around that. And now we're reading Wodehouse because my daughter loves Downton Abbey. So I thought, well, let's read some Wodehouse now. And we'll see how that goes.
Fantastic. Next, it's Rebecca Solnit.
Well, there are several literary references in the book. It's at Middlemarch. You talk about that you...
I love Middlemarch.
Middlemarch, and you reference that. And there definitely seems to be kind of a Shakespearean element to the two boys and their relationship, Jacob and Brett. And it does seem that you have a love of reading and you've brought a lot, you know, I can only imagine the books that you were exposed to when reading when you were growing up. That is all of that kind of swirling around in your head. So
absolutely, absolutely. You know, and Elizabeth and Gloria both are fantastic interlocutors about the world, right? So that was an education my whole life in how to talk and think compassionately and politically. So there's that too. I think I owe a tremendous debt to my parents simply because they held the way that we talk about things to a high standard of observation and integrity.
Is that why you think you were able to write about the dark parts of the book and the abuse that happens? Because if you're raised like that and you have such a high level of empathy from a young age, because I do think it is something that we need to teach kids. I think we often think, oh, this is stuff we're born with. But I see a whole lot of people who either got it knocked out of them or just never had it. I think these are skills we need to be teaching children, that you're able to identify that there are very dark parts of society that, you know, very often we don't want to talk about, like this awful abuse that happens in this family.
I feel like I could have had no better education in compassion and in close observation of the people in my life who matter to me and in taking seriously other minds than to be raised by Gloria and Elizabeth.
What's their reaction to the book?
I have always felt their unconditional love. I think that their reaction of support and admiration would have been the same if it were sitting in my desk drawer. And that's sort of a great feeling. I have always felt encouraged by my two amazing parents. And, you know, Elizabeth really encouraged me to take risks with my career. I kind of wanted to go into academia out of the idea that it was too terrifying to try and write a book. And Elizabeth was really a voice saying, you're young and you should be courageous and, you know, if you don't try and write, you will regret it forever. And if you fail, you'll embark upon your career a little bit later, but in the long run, that won't hurt you.
Sounds like it was good advice.
She gives the best advice.
I should go to her sometime. Maybe my next year. We're thinking of going to California next summer. I'll stop by.
Head up to Mendocino. After a book like this, that really, I can imagine the emotional outpouring that you had to go through. Because as a reader, you know, it takes some grit to get through some of the passages. I mean, ultimately, it's such a rewarding read. And, you know, the end, there is a, you know, redemptive, there is hope at the end. What was that like in terms of the emotional output from you as a writer? Because you're the one who has to think up this stuff.
You know, I have a friend who I really admire, who is a tremendous person and a very great artist. And we sometimes talk about art. And I remember, you know, talking to her, and she's like, oh, I've been doing this painting. It's so dark. It's so moody. And I was like, oh, what's that like? And she's like, well, it means I've just been reckoning with these really dark ideas for like a week. And I was like. So mad. Yeah, no, it was a very challenging, emotionally exhausting project. But, you know, it's hard to complain too much about that because I felt very seriously that I had to do this right. And if that's difficult, that's still like a privileged life, right? Like, and if taking seriously people who have been hurt and who weren't loved is a hard undertaking, so fucking be it.
I have to cough. Excuse me.
In the end of the book, Turtle's trying to grow a garden, and that's not going very well, and she's trying to persevere. And you know, I'm gonna admit to I've been grappling with this idea in my head, because a garden is kind of bringing nature into one's own home, sort of, and trying to tame nature. And I was trying to figure out what was happening there in a way. So she's unable to tame nature, but it seemed like such an interesting project for her, because she gets so much of her strength from going out into the wildness of nature. So I was trying to think if you could, you know, I'm asking for some help, because I didn't quite understand. I like the movement of it, but I intellectually I can't quite figure out why a garden rather than some other project, perhaps.
You know, Turtle's a caretaker. And enjoys taking care of things and being serious about them. And all of her, you know, all of her guns have been taken away. and, you know, and there's an element to that, which is I like gardens. Elizabeth is an avid gardener. I think that gardening is amazingly good for the soul. It's also my experience that gardening in the Redwoods is hard. I mean, that's just like, that's, I don't know. Sometimes I read about gardening, and it misses my experience of gardening, which is that it's tough and heartbreaking at times. You're trying to parse out the symbolism of it,
yes.
Right? You're trying to parse out the symbolism of it, and the symbolism is not sort of the primary, is not the primary part of that. The primary part of that is the simple reality that she's looking for a new life, trying to start a new life, and it's rocky. I mean, I think that's, I don't know if other people find this, but I find that everything I do in my life is hard, harder than you would think it would be. And so that seemed an essential part. If you're looking for the symbolism, there's an element to which Turtle is trying to make a new identity for herself, and her sort of vast prehistory of abuse is sort of itching at the doors of that, right? Like, she's literally having a problem where the roots are coming up into the garden bed, and it represents the way in which this subterranean element is choking out all of the nurturing that she needs to give to her new identity, her ambitions for her life. The roots are kind of seizing on every little drop of nurturing and soaking it up, so that it becomes very hard to build a new life. And mm-hmm. she's trying to insulate herself from that and can't. That's the symbolism. But the more important part is that I thought that a garden might legitimately be her next project. You know, also, eating is an act of resistance for Turtle. Like, she fasts in times of difficulty. Martin is often trying to feed her or to, you know, make meals, as an example of how he is as a parent, these sort of effete meals that show taste and culture. And Turtle is oftentimes demonstrating that she doesn't need this food, that she can scavenge, that she's resourceful, that she's not picky. And so growing her own food is meaningful to Turtle, who is a young woman who thinks about food very much in terms of resistance.
I thought those the breakfasts that she would have, crack a raw egg into her mouth.
Yes, over and over again, lots of raw eggs. Yeah, I thank you very much for that. You know, when I read it, I finished the book a few days ago, and I read it, and I kind of intuitively went with, yeah, gardening makes sense, and she's caring for it. But then I started thinking about the larger aspect of the book and what nature means, and trying to reconcile that. And it just goes to show, you know, sometimes you can tie yourself in knots sometimes when you read, and maybe even when you write, you know, trying to figure some of these things out.
At the end of the book, when, you know, the gardening happens, and, you know, they go to a gardening center, a nursery, and they're not charged for stuff. I think people are trying to give them stuff for free because people know who Turtle is. And there seems to be a sense of guilt in this community that nobody intervened and nobody saw what was going on. And we talked a little bit about that, that when adults fail children in this way, when abuse is hiding in plain sight and when they can see what's happening and they suspect it, but they fail to act, when it comes out, and we've seen this play out in real life, Penn State, you know, what's happened with the Catholic Church, or I mean, countless other examples, that there seems to be a collective hand-wringing on the part of the community. It's like, why did we not do anything? And yet it happens again and again, that entire communities or entire systems of adults fail to act when everybody seems to know that something very, very bad is happening.
Yeah, that's interesting. For me, and I think that's right. I think that's true. But I think that is one part of that. There is a way in which Turtle is deeply suspicious of the outside world, and the outside world doesn't, like, it's a challenging place, right? But it sometimes doesn't warrant all of that suspicion. Like, there is community. I think that no, like, any particular story you can tell about community is going to understate the complexity of the situation. But I think that is something that I wanted to get at, which is that there will be a community for Turtle, that the outside world isn't monolithically hostile, right? She will receive a welcome when she's ready.
And there is that sense that the community is coming together to support her, and that I think gives a real hopeful element to the ending.
Well, she experiences that earlier, right? She's very suspicious of a guy that Jacob and Brett. She's following Jacob. She's tailing Jacob and Brett through the woods, and they come across a cabin and a guy who's living out there. And Turtle is terrified for them, and ready to kill this guy. And her suspicions are sort of unwarranted, right? Like, he means these kids no harm. And so I think that, like, that there are bad things in the world, but I think also that you go out into the world and you meet people and you find friends. You find people who want to help.
Well, you've been listening to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It's a podcast, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Our guest, Gabriel Tallant, talking about his new book, My Absolute Darling. You can catch the full interview that we did with Gabriel at the book club edition of this, news.kgnu.org, or at the podcast.itunes. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thank you.
Thank you.